This episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner is brought to you by Lake Obabaka Lodge, a rustic luxury fishing lodge.
I do get questions like, well, why do you care so much about these? You're just shooting ducks and geese. And it's not just about ducks and geese. Yes, we're the Duck Hunters Organization, we're Delta Waterfowl, but we're supportive of all hunting. And our work, my work, my colleagues work with different other organizations who come to the forefront, local hunters in these municipalities. It's not about a species, it's about our ability to do it.
This week on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Networks, Diaries of a Lodge Owner, we dive deep into the heart of conservation, community, and the great outdoors. I'm your host, Steve Nedzwicki, and today it's my pleasure to bring you stories from the front lines of wildlife preservation and outdoor adventure. Live from the Toronto Sportsman Show, we cast a spotlight on a man whose unsung commitment is preserving our Canadian hunting heritage by working with policymakers through every level of government. He and his organization are also working hard to reshape the North American waterfowl landscape. His career has spanned almost two decades with the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters, and now practicing his craft with the remarkable organization, Delta Waterfowl. Delta Waterfowl stands as a beacon of hope and action in the fight for the future of waterfowl, with a mission that intertwines research, education, and advocacy. Delta is dedicated to sustainable solutions that benefit both wildlife and people. The pioneering of this organization has introduced innovative conservation programs that enhance waterfowl populations and strive to add 1 million ducks per year while supporting the traditions of waterfowl hunting. From groundbreaking research to youth education programs designed to ignite a passion for outdoor conservation, Delta Waterfowl's impact is profound and far-reaching. Their work not only preserves biodiversity in our wetlands, but also strengthens the bonds between humans and the natural world. So folks, join us as we explore the stories of dedication, innovation, and adventures that define Delta. And it is now my honor to introduce to all of you this fine gentleman, amazing father, and true champion of our outdoor heritage, Brian McCray. We're live. Hello and welcome, folks, to another episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner. We're here live at the Toronto Sportsman Show. Yes, you've heard it before and you'll hear it again. This time I am absolutely, totally excited to have a wonderful friend and a guy that is extremely knowledgeable in so many areas. And it is good friend Brian McCray from Delta Waterfowl. How you doing, Brian?
I'm good, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
I see my check cash for all those nice things that you said about me.
Well, you know, I might have went a little over, so don't be surprised if you see a little invoice. Right on.
I'm good.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. Show's been great so far.
Yeah. It's, you know what? Today's been a good crowd.
Yeah.
Yesterday was a steady Thursday, which is always nice to see. I think tomorrow's going to be a busy day.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. And, you know, this has been such a great time for us because we get to talk face to face on the podcast with the people that we all know and love, and you know, and then we get guys in here that I love even more, like you. But anyway, Brian, I want to talk to you about Brian McCray and get to know you. I know that our roots run fairly deep, but how did you get involved with what you're doing today? And let's start from that, because you've got an interesting past.
Yeah, well, so I've been an angler and a hunter all my life.
Yep.
I was fortunate enough to grow up in an outdoor family and got lots of experiences. Some of my earliest memories are tagging along with my dad going out deer hunting. and sitting in a little 12-foot tinner with a four-horse Johnson, fishing sunfish on the Mississippi Lake. So I was very fortunate. Then we moved to the Mississippi Lake where I grew up on, and obviously having the resource right there, the love and passion just kind of grew and expanded. And you know, fast forward a number of years, I got an opportunity to join and work with the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters and kind of work through the ranks there, which has ultimately led me to with Delta Waterfowl now.
Right on. So let's go back and talk a little bit about what you did as far as your education and your college years in particular, because that I think that's where our paths kind of crossed.
Yeah, so I was probably a typical college student. Started college, didn't really like the path I was going down. Got out of college for a while, went to the workforce, ended up getting a wrist injury, which kind of changed my path again. Went back to college, went to Fleming College in Peterborough, graduated the recreational leisure program there, and then kind of went total opposite direction of that program and landed in policy and advocacy world within you know, fishing and hunting world. So
that is definitely reflective of how my college went. I ended up wanting to go for you know, to be a game warden, and then ended up in ecosystem management, and got out of ecosystem management, and the whole while I was kind of financing that by working in a sheet metal shop, and then I ended up being a sheet metal mechanic for, you know, 15 years. So, but this, I'd like to really dive into the policy side of things that you briefly mentioned. Tell us a little bit about what you were doing in policy, and I can definitely reinforce how important that is. And we'll talk about our experience together, but lay the groundwork for what you were doing and who you were doing it for.
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess I'll start with saying that, you know, my current role with Delta Waterfowl, I'm the Director of Government Affairs Canada. So from a policy world and an advocacy world, I deal with all levels of government, from municipal levels, as you know, which we'll talk about, right to provincial, and right up to the federal levels.
Yeah.
So essentially, if something comes up that may impact our ability to hunt in particular.
Yeah. Which is our God-given right.
Which is, you know, it's a national and provincial heritage activity. We're going to get involved as an organization.
Yeah.
So it's great. You know, a lot of folks look at policy and kind of the advocacy world as maybe not their, you know, their first choice of a profession, but I actually find it really, really rewarding. And, you know, I always tell this story, especially in working in a municipal stuff. Some of the first memories I have of hunting with my dad, like I talked to you about, are now in areas where people can't hunt because of municipal discharge of fire and bylaw issues. And those memories I will have for the rest of my days. I remember, I could tell you every single aspect of that hunt. My dad actually shot an 8-point buck, which, you know, my son over here is watching us. He knows how Papa shoots. So, you know, for him to get a deer is pretty special. But I could tell you every single thing about that hunt. And those memories will last with me. And for me, I take that into what I do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, listen, you said you can't hunt there anymore.
That's right.
And it's got to, right now I'm feeling upset because for you in particular, you have those memories, yet you know that you'll never share those memories in those same spots with your son.
Yes. You know, and there's a lot of factors, obviously, that go into into discharge bylaws. You know, urban growth is a big one, as we know. But for me, I kind of I look at it as the bigger picture, in that we need to protect the areas and we need to educate the folks who are making these decisions to ensure that that doesn't happen. Are we ever going to eliminate it?
No.
No. Can we help to slow it down? Absolutely. And can we affect change in areas, especially through education, especially with counselors and MPs, depending on whatever file you're working on? Absolutely. And education is probably the biggest part of it. And that's what I really find really enjoyable about the work that I do, because it's, you can see the difference, and you can, when a person comes up and says, "Hey, thanks, you know, I can do X in this area," or, "You know what, we have the ability to do Y," that means a lot. And that in policy, sometimes things take a long time to happen. But when they do happen, you got to celebrate them.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, let's talk about some of those championing moments in your policy. And that's what you've done now for how many years?
I'm with Delta for a year and a half, but before joining Delta Waterfowl, I was the senior advisor for the Ontario Federation of Anglers and Hunters.
That's right.
I was with them for 14 years. So really, I've been involved in this game for, we'll say 15 years for argument's sake.
In policy.
And
so what are some of those champions?
Yeah, so great question. So, as I said earlier, we really get engaged at the three levels. Probably in Ontario, our greatest threat is at the municipal level. And the reason I say that is, especially for hunters and recreational shooters, municipal discharge of firearm bylaws can reduce or prohibit your ability to discharge a firearm, hunt in urban or rural areas, basically with one complaint. So, if you look back, if I look back over probably the last 12 to 14 years, I have personally been involved in about 70 different municipal discharge of firearm bylaws across Ontario. And that extends right from Atikokan to the tips of southern Ontario. There's not really one spot that it doesn't happen in. They happen all over the place. And it's important for folks to know that there is someone there to help when stuff like that comes up. So, discharge of firearms bylaws, obviously advocating for access to opportunity through Sunday gun hunting initiatives.
Absolutely.
Is a huge one.
Well, I can attest to that. I was one of those situations.
Yes,
I was a counselor on the township of Amaranth. And I didn't realize that our heritage could be attacked in a way that it all of a sudden was being attacked in my own township. And I was very lucky to be a counselor involved in the situation. And I'll paint the situation without using names. And not, to be honest with you, I probably don't even remember the names anymore anyway. But we had a situation within the township where we had a group of people who were target shooting with high-powered weapons. And for those of you who don't know what a country concession is, but that's basically the space between two lines or two roads. And typically back in the day, there were 200 acres, each 100-acre farm. And from one road to the other road, you would have two parcels of land that touch in the back. And then you've got the road frontage on each side. So the people that were discharging the firearms or target shooting were doing so without a proper backing. And these bullets were traveling through the concession and across the road on the far side and were being embedded into a house.
Yep.
And that is a very, very concerning thing to have happen. And when it first come to council, because the police for reasons that we also worked out couldn't do anything about the situation. So it was brought to a municipal level, and everybody on council was just appalled, including myself, and upset at the people that were doing this. But what happened was the first knee-jerk reaction was to say, okay, you're not allowed to shoot guns anymore. You can't shoot guns anymore. And for me, coming from a farming background, a hunting background, that's like saying, oh, I got an earache. Let's just cut off your head and we'll fix that problem. It wasn't okay with me to not be able to discharge a firearm. Now we're talking about farmers who have the right to protect their livestock not being able to discharge a weapon. So I was very thankful, and I wasn't the one that brought you in, but our secretary, she brought you in, and very quickly, as soon as I knew you were on the job, I was like, oh my God, this is wonderful, because there was a lot of opposition. I feel like if I wasn't involved and if you weren't involved, I feel that there would have been a discharge of firearms bylaw implemented in the township of Amaranth that would have severely restricted hunters, especially, and farmers from using firearms over this unfortunate incident. And it was an incident that happened more than once, unfortunately. And it was an incident that the police could not police, go figure, because they could not prove who was pulling the trigger.
Well, that was the biggest part, right? Obviously, police have a tough job to do.
It is a tough
and
job.
100%, it was the fault of the person who was discharging the firearm. But they can't go in and carte blanche charge every single person for a crime when only one person actually did that.
So let's talk about this situation a little bit.
Yeah, so that was an interesting one. And, you know, to be honest, a lot of them go that way. In that particular situation, you know, that's a situation that thankfully doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah.
Actually, it's quite rare. And it was a situation that had to be dealt with.
Yes.
And you're right. There was a ton of opposition.
Well, it's the optics are so terrible.
Well, and you know what? The optics are, you know, unfortunately, hunters and recreational shooters are painted with a one brush stroke.
Yeah.
You know, people see, they watch movies, they hear about what's going on south of the border, and then something happens and it's firearms.
See, this is what,
that situation, it was great that we were able to get involved in, and education was, you know, it prevailed. It was key in that one, and it prevailed. And if we hadn't gotten involved, you're right, there would have been a mass restriction in that area, and there would have been loss of opportunities for people. You know, a person wouldn't have been able to go, you know, grandfather wouldn't have been able to take their grandson or granddaughter out, shoot pellet guns on the farm. Like, how ridiculous is that, right? Shooting pop cans with a pellet gun on a 100-acre farm. People wouldn't be able to go deer hunting. People wouldn't be able to go duck hunting, goose hunting.
And I'll just interject right there, because this is the right moment to really explain to people how important municipal law can be and municipal government can be, and how important it is for you to kind of keep a pulse on what's going on in your very own township, or your small town, but especially in a township like Amaranth. Like I say, all of my friends who are hunters and farmers and people who have lived and hunted their whole lives had no clue about what was going on.
No, and that's always the case. You know, I'll give you an example right now, living. So right now, you know, as an organization, these files are really important to us. In the last year alone, Delta Waterfowl is engaged in, well, actually, we made a graph for our booth that says 10, but I just had another municipality have a conversation this week. So in the last year, we've been involved in 11 different discharge of firearm bylaws in the last year alone.
Yeah.
One of the ones I'm working on right now is in Temagami.
I don't even understand that.
And this one was crazy. Now, luckily, there's been a lot of vocal locals and residents come forward. Obviously, we were there as an organization in opposition of it. But that's a situation in Temagami where there's been a lot of amalgamation with smaller communities that it put at risk and jeopardized outfitters. A lot of you know, bear management.
Yeah.
Up in Temagami.
Yeah.
A lot of trapping, a lot of people who owned cottages and recreational property that wouldn't even be able to shoot a grouse on their property. You know, the outfitters, if they were bringing in bear hunters, they wouldn't even be able to sight their bows or rifles in at the lodge, the way it was worded. There was a lot of issues. Luckily, we're working, and it's going to be repealed.
Yeah.
But that's just another example of how these things can come in and impact the lives of everybody. And there was no real justification for it. And, so this is where it gets challenging, because a municipality can create, draft, amend a discharge of firearms bylaw under Section 119 of the Municipal Act, which, you know, basically the under public safety. Those two words give the power for municipalities to stop hunting and recreational shooting in a municipality. The unfortunate part is there are no guidelines. And, you know, that's one thing that us as an organization are trying to tackle. It's going to be a long, long, hard battle, but we need to have guidelines. We need to have lines on the road where a municipality can't just say, Steve called in, he heard a shot, and we're going to shut down hunting.
Yeah.
We can't have that. And right now that ability exists, which is unfortunate. That's why I said early on that this is one of probably our largest threat in Ontario for hunters and recreational shooters.
Municipal.
At the municipal level.
Yeah.
And you know, there's, as we know, hunters and firearms owners, we're the most vetted, we're the most trained, we're the safest demographic. If we look at hunter statistics, M&R have the statistics. I get them every year. Hunting is one of the safest recreational activities a person can participate in. The accident rate is like 0.000014 or something like
that.
You know, there's 470,000 licensed and trained hunters in Ontario. Public safety is at the forefront of everything that we do when we're out in the field, when we have young lads like we have sitting out here, when we're taking them to the duck blind.
Yeah.
It's trained, it's taught to them at a very early age about gun safety and the importance of following rules and regulations. So where I'm going with this is, not only do hunters have to abide by federal rules and regulations as it pertains to their firearms, when they're out hunting, they have all the provincial rules and regulations, as you know, and we have to abide by the municipal. And that's where municipal discharge bylaws are our largest threat, because they can't supersede. They're not supposed to call them hunting bylaws, but they circumvent
by safety.
By safety. So we're trying to push
that verbiage.
That's right. So we're trying to push for lines on the road, definitions of public safety, justification for a municipality to show proof that there actually is a public safety concern. You saying there's a public safety issue
doesn't
and there
mean it.
Actually is being a public safety issue are two very different things.
Yeah.
And we're also working and trying to get the Ministry of Natural Resources and Forestry engaged anytime there is a municipal bylaw or issue that will impact hunting, trapping, or fishing. Because we've had fishing bylaws pop up. You know, I remember in my days with OFH, the municipalities trying to enact fishing bylaws. So we want to get the ministry.
What kind of a bylaw?
Like the Ganaraska.
To restrict access
to opportunity, et cetera, right? But we want M&R to jump in and get involved, because at the end of the day, we talked about it. Hunting and fishing are heritage activities.
Yes.
It's recognized at the federal level. On the third Saturday of September, it was National Fishing, Hunting, Trapping Heritage Day. It's recognized Ontario provincially as a heritage activity. And when we have our abilities to participate in those activities taken away from us without justification, there's a trickle-down effect to that. Not only do we lose that opportunity, but now that might mean somebody can't go out hunting in their area. So what does that mean? Well, that person then doesn't go. He doesn't buy hunting licenses.
Yep.
And what does that mean? Well, hunting licenses and fishing licenses in Ontario, the money from those licenses goes into the SPA account, which is the government fund, which funds all of the
restocking programs,
wildlife management, conservation officers, etc. in Ontario. So it's not just...
You're losing revenue to drive what we have to do with our resource.
Conservation initiatives, wildlife management, having the COs on the ground, making sure that people are following the rules and regulations. Hey, look, as an organization, if someone's breaking the law, knowingly breaking the law, they deserve to be charged.
Yes.
100%. You know, we have fantastic conservation officers in Ontario. And you know, even they educate. People can make honest mistakes. But if someone is knowingly breaking the law, knowingly, whether they're shooting out of season, shooting
out
of
your car,
whatever the case may be, you know, in your situation, that was a situation that had to be dealt with.
Yes.
100%. But it's not, you know, it's such a deep topic, which makes it very important to us as an organization.
And we will revisit that whole situation, because I think it's very interesting for people listening to hear from both sides of the coin.
Absolutely.
From the side that I was sitting on, which is counselor within, and although we did have the same intention, It's interesting to hear from both sides, but yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, and it's not only that, it's also, you know, it's important to hear from the people who have their concerns, because people have their beliefs, which is fantastic. And I hope everyone always continues to do that. And that's where education comes in, because if someone has a serious concern or a fear, maybe they're misguided, whatever the case may be, a lot of times just a good conversation can provide a lot of valuable information both ways. And, you know, when I approach these municipal discharge firearm bylaws or Sunday gun hunting issues, or it doesn't matter the topic, you're always going to have people on both sides. And it's important to understand where they're coming from, because if they're acting or speaking out against something with an idea in their head, wherever they got that idea,
yeah,
it might be true.
And it might not be.
And it might not be true. And if you have the ability to have a sound conversation and just say, well, you know, here are some facts about topic X, it can help go a long way. And that's, you know, as an organization, that's what we pride ourselves on, is being a reputable organization.
Well, and having that data is the only leverage that you really have when you engage in these conversations with people that, and unfortunately, in today's day and age, it seems like it's cancel culture, and hunting and fishing and all of these outdoor activities seem to be on the chopping block. And for somebody to be able to just say, hey, I heard gunshots and I think that somebody was on my property and let's go and stop this. And then for us to have to get involved in something like that, and the situation we're going to talk about with the Township of Amaranth is different. But from what I'm hearing is all you need to do is complain.
Well, and that's, you know,
and convince five councillors and a mayor.
Sadly, yes. And that's why we need, that's why we're working hard to get that change.
Yes.
Because it's going to continue. Like I said, we've been involved in 11 over the last year, right? But, you know, I'm going to go a totally different way here in that.
But that data is important.
The data is important. But, you know, so I go back to us as an organization, and we, you know, obviously the advocacy piece is what I do and what my boss, Jim Fisher, does. So we have two policy guys in Canada. We've got three in the U.S., but we also have a ton of other programs as an organization, which all help to feed kind of the engine, to feed the beast, right? So we talk about the advocacy standpoint, but, you know, we have a program we call R3, which is recruit, reactivate, retain. And, you know, we're trying to recruit new people. We're trying to retain the folks that we have, and we're trying to reactivate, you know, the folks that stopped hunting for various reasons. Through that, we have also programs that are looking to educate our next line of wildlife managers through a program called the University Hunt Program. Yep, the University Hunting Program, where we're targeting, you know, colleges and universities. Last year alone, that we just wrapped up, we had 103 universities and colleges between Canada and the U.S. put on these university hunting programs, where we are taking our future wildlife managers and giving them their first experience duck and goose hunting. Why that is important? It's important because in this day and age, we are seeing more and more people getting into enforcement positions that might not have a background or might not have a lot of knowledge for one reason or another. Maybe they get into a course. We get talked about college early on. You know, you start in one program, you end up in another program. So, you know, programs like this, which we are investing heavily in and we're promoting, they're all intertwined together, which kind of makes it really exciting as an organization to work with Delta Waterfowl Foundation, because we're tackling so many different topics, but they're all intertwined, right from maybe taking someone out for their first hunts, you know, getting these two young lads out on their first duck hunts, give them a good experience. They get their license early. They learn, they get to university. Maybe they go on the university hunt program that's put on through their college, right? They become wildlife managers. Maybe they become conservation officers, wherever it leads, but it's giving them a base knowledge. It's giving them a life experience. And even if they don't get into those fields, it's giving them a level of knowledge that, oh,
yeah,
I heard a gunshot. it's probably someone out duck hunting.
Yes.
Or goose hunting. Yes. Right? It's not, it doesn't go the opposite way where I heard a gunshot.
I'm scared.
And that happens. And you know what? I'll never take that away from somebody. I will never, ever, ever criticize someone for acting that way.
Yeah.
Everyone's brought up differently.
Yeah.
But it's important to have those conversations and reassure them. And as you said, provide input and stats on all of that stuff.
Yes. And like that's your leverage. And educating at the grassroots level is the way, is the best way to do it, right? And I'm so happy to hear that you're putting that kind of effort in. Delta is putting that kind of effort in to educate at grassroots levels. We took it for granted. You know, when I grew up on a farm, I grew up out in farm country. I was able to jump on my bike and bike down the road to the bridge and fish. I was lucky that I got to go out and shoot guns on the property and hunt for deer and hunt for ducks and geese. But a lot of people today don't have that opportunity, and it's so important for us to make it available for everyone to be able to do that.
Escape to the wilderness of Lake Obabaka Lodge, where the exclusivity of a fly-in meets the accessibility of a drive-to destination. Cast its pristine waters teeming with trophy lakers, northern pike, and smallmouth bass. Discover a paradise rich with history, offering serene moments and adventurous days. Lake Obabaka Lodge is where memories are hooked and history comes alive. Join us where the wilderness whispers your name.
Hi, everybody. I'm Angelo Viola.
And I'm Pete Bowman.
Now, you might know us as the hosts of Canada's favorite fishing show, but now we're hosting a podcast.
That's right. Every Thursday, Ange and I will be right here in your ears, bringing you a brand new episode of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Now, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours every week?
Well, you know there's going to be a lot of fishing.
I knew exactly where those fish were going to be and how to catch them, and they were easy to catch.
Yeah, but it's not just a fishing show. We're going to be talking to people from all facets of the outdoors, from athletes.
All the other guys would go golfing. Me and Garth and Turk and all the Russians would go fishing.
To scientists.
But now that we're reforesting and letting things, it's the perfect transmission environment for Lyme disease.
To chefs.
If any game isn't cooked properly,
marinated,
you will taste it.
And whoever else will pick up the phone.
Wherever you are, Outdoor Journal Radio seeks to answer the questions and tell the stories of all those who enjoy being outside.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What brings people together more than fishing and hunting?
How about food?
I'm Chef Antonio Maleca, and I have spent years catering to the stars. Now, on Outdoor Journal Radio's Eat and Wild podcast, Louise, Hookset, and I are bringing our expertise
and Rolodex to our real passion, the outdoors.
Each week, we're bringing you inside the boat, tree stand, or duck blind and giving you real advice that you can use to make the most out of your fishing game.
You're going to flip that duck breast over once you get a nice hard sear on that breast. You don't want to sear the actual meat.
And it's not just us chatting here. If you can name a celebrity, we've probably worked with them. And I think you might be surprised who likes to hunt and fish.
When Kit Harrington asks me to prepare him sashimi with his bass, I couldn't say no.
Whatever Taylor Sheridan wanted, I made sure I had it.
Burgers, steak, anything off the barbecue. That's a true cowboy.
All Jeremy Renner wanted to have was lemon ginger shots all day.
Find Eating Wild now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
So do you guys have any kind of programs that promote hunting and fishing and trying to get people in involved that maybe new Canadians or people that just never have had the opportunity to do this? Because I believe, and I'm telling everybody right now listening, and that it is so important for one's mental health, physical health, well-being as a whole, to get out into nature, get out and participate in activities that bring you back to your roots. And just because you're living on Front Street in Toronto and you've lived there your whole life doesn't mean that your roots don't come from hunters and gatherers.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you've got that, you know. So what are you you doing to kind of encourage those people?
Yeah, so before I jump into that, you struck on a point there, and you know, it's something that I get asked all the time, especially, you know, these files are extremely important to us as,
yes,
as a duck hunting and a, you know, we're the duck hunters organization for duck and goose hunting. I do get questions like, well, why do you care so much about these? You're just shooting ducks and geese. And yeah, it's not just about ducks and geese.
No.
Yes, we're the duck hunters organization. We're Delta Waterfowl, but we're supportive of all hunting. And our work, my colleagues work with different other organizations who come to the forefront, local hunters in these municipalities. It's not about a species. It's about our ability to do it. And I get that asked question. And you're right. We are a duck hunters organization. And are other folks going to benefit? 100%. And
yes,
I am 3,000,000% okay with that, because
yes,
it is our heritage. So
yes,
I just wanted to throw that out there. I do get that question, but you know, we'll do it with Delta Waterfowl. But our work is I'm also talking as a turkey hunter. I'm also,
yes,
talking as a deer hunter.
Yes.
I'm also talking as a bear hunter and a rabbit hunter and,
yeah,
grouse hunter and all those things.
And
right?
The reason, and I'm just going to throw it out there, the reason I believe that these activities are so important to our health, and I mentioned it. Number one, people are not getting into nature the way that we used to and the way that we need to. Hunting and fishing is an activity that puts you in nature. Okay? It's mentally,
yep,
for your mind. You get out and sit some of the best, most relaxing times that I have are sitting in a tree stand in October on opening day with a bow. And you know, I make sure I put my seatbelt on because I've been known to fall asleep, right? But those days with the fall breeze and the smells and just quiet, to unplug your mind is so, so important.
Well, and you know, you're absolutely right. And it kind of comes full circle, because now, you know, I'm in a position right now. We just went through the first fall where my son Bryce he got licensed last year. So last year was his first year as a youth apprentice.
Yeah.
So it wasn't me behind the gun. It was him. And for me, that was a whole new level and appreciation. And thinking back now to all the things that we touched on is, you know, I hope he remembers that, you know,
yeah,
when he's older, because I can tell you that I'm going to remember those, you know, and you know, he's a grown boy. There's a reason we have to go hunting so much too. I got to stock the freezer because this kid's eating me out of the house at home. But.
And you're touching on my second point that I want to talk about is this is a bit of a health focus for this section, but the quality of the protein that you can obtain for, I'm gonna say free, but it's not really free, because you still have to have your gun, you gotta have your bullets, you gotta have this, you gotta pay for that, you know, you need your calls. But that is to get that protein in such a healthy way to start with, from a healthy source, is second to none.
It really is, actually. It's, you know, I always liken it to, you know, people have their own thing of what they want to spend money on. You know, people could go out golfing and spend.
Yep.
I'm not a golfer. I don't profess to be. I'm a horrible golfer, to be honest. But
fun.
You know, you spend a lot of money on one day to go golfing.
Yeah.
Whereas I might choose to go sit in a tree stand. You know, maybe my bow cost, my wife's not listening, you know, my bow cost $2,000,
yep,
or whatever the case may be. That was a one-time purchase. It's going to provide me with 10, 15, 20 years of experience of getting out there.
Yeah.
So in my mind, you're absolutely right. It's not free, but when I, or when Bryce or whomever, when we harvest a deer, or we harvest ducks, to me, that's going to the grocery store, or we go out fishing. We put a limit of crappie in the boat,
yeah,
right? That is, you know, we're going to enjoy it. You know, I always joke. So I mentioned to you, Bryce plays hockey for the Oshawa Generals, the AAA team. And we always joke because his pregame meal is pasta and duck, seared duck.
That's awesome.
His teammates, actually, Braden's looking at me. He's mad because he got to experience it too. He's wishing he lived at the McRae residence. But
yeah, no doubt.
His teammates joke because, you know, he's having, you know, I think the last game it was a mallard, two mallard breasts seared in cast iron,
yeah,
with pasta.
Oh, man.
Right? But it's that protein, right?
Like, yeah,
it's natural, it's organic, it's, you know,
yeah,
it could have been the one he shot, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, just going back to your question about you know, what we do as an organization. You know, I touched on the R3 is important, the university hunt programs, our first hunt programs. We have, you know, obviously we have members throughout Ontario, we have members throughout Canada, we have members across North America, Delta Waterfowl's home offices in the States.
Yeah.
You know, so we have folks everywhere. But, you know, at the chapter level, that's where a lot of our ground, you know, the groundwork, the grassroots stuff happens. In your local communities, they're putting on youth hunts. They're putting on women's hunts. They're providing opportunities for people to get out for the first time. They're doing conservation work in their areas. They're putting up hen houses out. They're putting wood duck boxes out. They're doing garbage cleanup. There's opportunities. So where I'm going with this is, you know, it's a little bit of a plug for Delta, but it's important for people of, you know, if you're interested in that sort of stuff, go to a fundraising dinner.
Yeah.
You know, Delta puts them on all the time. And, you know, it's a great, great opportunity to meet with like-minded people. Maybe you start a new chapter. You got a bunch of buddies, you know, that are interested in it. But it's that grassroots connection.
Yes.
That you can get through dinners. And we're obviously just one organization that puts them on. But duck hunting is different than other forms of hunting.
Yeah. I've got a quick question about your chapters.
Sure.
How do we find out where the chapters are based?
Yeah.
Is that online?
Yeah, right on our website. And you can go on and click. Put me on the spot now. I can't remember which tab it is.
Like,
but there's like a find me button.
Yeah.
And you can see and you can zoom into where your closest chapter is. And you can.
And it doesn't cost you anything to join the chapter?
No. So it's kind of cool because if you come to a Delta dinner, you get a full membership.
Where do we find out where these dinners are?
You can online. You can find the chapter. There's contact information. We also, for the folks that are around here, we've got information at our booths.
Yeah.
We have our chapters are having dinners, fundraising dinners. They're happening right now. We've got some coming up in June. They kind of happen throughout the year. And what's really cool about Delta is 15% of the money raised, they have access to do initiatives in their community.
In their chapter.
They're like all those activities that we were talking about, they're putting them on to get more people involved, more people engaged. And that's where people can start up new chapters. There's no cost to get involved in a chapter. The cost is your time. And when we look at it that way, it's not time. It's either people are getting involved because they have a passion for it.
Yeah.
They have a desire to do it. They want to get involved. They want to give back. They want to connect with kids. It's healthy. There's so many reasons why they want to get involved, right? So on our Delta Waterfowl website, there's a link that you can look up a chapter, etc.
Awesome. Okay. Now back to the duck hunting is so different.
Yeah. So I was saying that. So I've had this conversation a ton this weekend already.
Yeah.
Duck and goose hunting are totally different than, you know, someone who's going out turkey hunting or deer hunting, because it's really a more social activity.
I was just going
to
say.
Right? You know, I take my son out. If we go to the deer stand, you know, he sniffles too loud. I'm like, Bryce.
Or if you smell wrong.
So
God forbid somebody lights a cigar.
but where I'm going with it, like, you know, duck and goose hunting, you know, we always joke, you get a bunch of guys out in a field that have layout blinds, and, you know, I always brag about my ab of steel. You know, Bryce and Braden sitting over there with their six packs. I got my ab of steel. So you picture, you know, five or six or seven, you know, bigger guys that are out of their layout blinds, and all of a sudden a flock of geese are coming, and you see like seven fat guys running down. But that's where I'm going. It's an experience. You know, people cook breakfast out when they're duck hunting and goose hunting, right? You can chat with people. You can joke around. You don't have to be so quiet. That's why it's such an easy way to get kids involved, new people, new Canadians. It doesn't matter. You know, we want to grow our numbers.
Yeah.
Heck, if someone is listening to this and lives near me and has never done it, I want to take you out because it's a great community of people. It's a community, and it's just such a you can have so much fun, and that's what makes it different. And I'm a diehard deer hunter. I'm a diehard turkey hunter, and I enjoy those. But when I can take people out and they shoot 30 shots at a duck and then they finally hit one and they're hooting and hollering, right? Yeah. Like, to me, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what makes it appealing for people, because you can move around more. you can joke around more, and it's just that sense of community and camaraderie.
Well, and the hunting and fishing community, and I can attest for this as a lodge owner in the business for over a decade, the hunting and fishing community of people is such a great community of people. They attract great people. They, you know, I can't think in 10 years I actually have two people on my blacklist. Most of you know about that. But anyway, other than two people on my blacklist over a decade, there are so many great people and so genuine and just want to share the experiences that they have.
Some of my closest and most dear friends I have met through the outdoor community.
Yeah.
Through hunting and fishing. Some of my best memories are in the outdoor community.
Yeah.
With, you know, with those friends, with family. You know, I talked about, you know, Bryce getting his first duck and first goose, you know, whether it's your first fish, you know, fishing off the dock with a, you know, a Batman fishing rod and you're catching your first bluegill off the dock, right? Like those are memories that mean something.
They're monumental memories.
They're monumental. Yes. And you know that, you know, you spoke on a bit earlier about just the importance of making it more accessible for folks, making it more welcoming, engaging. You know, there's a, we've got huge numbers, you know, in the angling world, it's 1.4 million licensed anglers. That doesn't include folks over 65, under 18.
Yeah.
You know, the number's higher. There's 470,000 licensed hunters in the province. There's about 10,000, I think, licensed trappers in the province. Yeah. There's a lot of people that live in Ontario.
Yes.
And if we could get, you know, think of what we could achieve if we can get more people involved, if we can, you know, make ourselves more accessible to people. And that's what, you know, from a hunting standpoint, from a waterfowling standpoint, as an organization, that's what we're trying to do.
Well, that's that is great work. It really is. So I'd like to now, well, you know what, we've had this kind of thread of health that's kind of come through our conversation so far. And I have one more point, third and final point, that I want to really touch on, and then we can leave that alone and then maybe go back and finish our conversation with the amaranth thing, because it is interesting from both sides. But third and final, and really one of the most important things, as far as I'm concerned, when you start talking about how healthy hunting and fishing is for a person, is the exercise. The physical exercise that you can employ. You don't always have to, because they're both two activities that can be accessible for anybody regardless of your health condition. But getting out into nature and walking, you know.
Getting outside.
Yes.
Right? What was, you know, you think back a few years when we couldn't do anything, what was one of the things we could do? We could go outside.
Yeah.
There's so many benefits to health just getting outside.
Yeah.
From mental health to physical health. And you're right. Depending on your level of experience, depending on restriction that you may have, you know.
Restriction might be, you get out and you do it to the best of your ability.
100%. And you know, kind of ties back to making everything more accessible.
Yeah.
Right? It's important. It's important for people to go out. You know what? If you go fishing, keep a fish. You don't have to throw every fish back. Enjoy it.
Yes.
Have a fish fry.
Yes. And there's a difference between keeping it and enjoying it, because so many people, and as from the perspective of a lodge owner, I see this, I saw it. And when you keep a fish, don't keep that fish for your Portuguese neighbor five doors down. And then by the end of the week that you're staying with me at Chaudière Lodge, say, you know what? Why don't you keep it? It's a pain. No, that's not how it works. If you're going to keep a fish or harvest venison or whatever, make sure that you're doing it to enjoy with yourself and your family, and that does not go to waste.
Well, I always joke. So I'm a diehard waterfowler. I love duck and goose hunting. Goose poppers are probably the number one ranked item at the barbecue at our house in the summer. The boys are
not. Oh my god! Okay, so
but here's where I'm going with this, yes, is share that, right? If you have the ability to have something, share it with people who don't normally try it. Because I can tell you know. I didn't make the recipe up, but, you know, bacon wrap, jalapeno, cream cheese stuffed goose poppers on the barbecue. They do not last on the plate. People will stand at the barbecue and pluck them off when they're piping hot.
Oh, but my God.
Even people.
I'm hungry.
Well, it's solid. But even people who've never tried it, they may be reluctant to start. But it's where I'm going with this is when, you know, if you don't know how to prepare, ask.
Yes.
There's lots of resources. Ask someone who does. Ask someone who's done it before.
Go to the University of YouTube.
YouTube, Mr. Google, anything. Yeah. But you know what? If you have the ability and you have stuff and you know folks are coming in that aren't from the, you know, hunting and fishing background, if they're willing, prepare something for them. Let them try it, because that might be one of the reasons why they're not doing it.
That's right.
That could be one
of the reasons that they start doing it.
That's right. Right? Remove barriers. That's a barrier for some people.
Yeah.
Lack of knowledge. Maybe they don't want to try it. It's out of my, you know, it's not really what I would normally try.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, the goose poppers are lights out.
And I can't
tell you how many people have tried them. And now when they come back, you're like, so we're the goose poppers.
I know. And I used to do a lot of goose hunting too. And I just loved goose breast. It's very simple, cast iron, butter, salt, thin, you know, quarter inch slices, and just magic.
Oh, that's, well, I told you about the pregame meal for his games. That's the way I do his duck. And, you know, you cook them medium rare.
Yes.
Butter.
Yes.
I actually put a little Montreal steak spice on top and then, you know, set them, let them stand for a minute or two.
It's one of those meats that you can cook medium rare.
That's right. You slice it. And then I drizzle the leftover little bit of butter and the spices over top of it. And he's like, it's
the au jus.
I'm
not sure if I use that term correctly, but I'm sure Antonio will correct me sometime.
You think someone who, you know, took the time to cook them the pregame meal and, you know, probably cleaned it, and, you know, you think a dad would get a bite, but not a chance.
Yeah, no way. That's awesome.
But your point is valid. Like if you're going to take advantage of it and you're gonna keep something from the resource, you also owe it to the resource, right? Like it's that anglers and hunters pride ourselves on being, you know, the most, you know, we're forward thinking, we're conservationists. We don't not want to see the resource go to waste.
We are the protector of the resource.
We are, right? So absolutely. Keep a fish every once in a while.
Absolutely.
If you keep a fish every time you go out, that's absolutely do it. If you don't want it, that's fine.
If you're if you're within your legal rights,
that's right.
You can keep that. Just don't waste it.
That's right.
Don't waste it. Because if you're gonna bring your two or your four walleye or whatever it might be home, and you're gonna take the time to clean it or have a friend clean it at the cottage for you, and you really want to take it and you take it home and it sits in the freezer for a year and a half, and when you're cleaning out the freezer in 2 years and there's the walleye that Brian filleted for me, that's wrong.
Not too much goes to waste around our house.
No,
my problem is I maybe can't. I'm not a good enough angler. I can't catch enough fish. Keep up.
Yeah. So you know that's an important and I think within the community, 95% of people, maybe even more. I'll go as far to say as 98% of the people within the community understand that it's our responsibility to educate the people who may not be within the community that we're bringing in, because it's very easy for somebody to go out fishing for the first time, get excited about having fish and then taking a whack home and having it all go to waste. So I did my very best at the lodge to make sure that if you were going to keep your fish, that you were going to take it home. And when you suggested that I keep it, I kept it because I knew that they probably weren't going to eat it anyway.
That's right.
And we used it on our fish fry the following Thursday. But I did make sure to educate them on not doing that.
That's right.
Right?
That's
right. So.
We interrupt this program to bring you the much anticipated bonus code for the latest Diaries of a Lodge Owner giveaway. This week's code is Luxury. That's capital L U X U R Y. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 entries towards our Lake Obabaka Lodge giveaway. For those who aren't entered, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishincanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fish in Canada giveaways. Now back to the episode. We interrupt this program to bring you the much anticipated bonus code for the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network's giveaway. This week's code is Diaries. That's D-I-A-R-I-E-S. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards a Garmin LiveScope Plus system. For those of you who aren't entered, what are you waiting for? Head over to fishincanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fish in Canada giveaways. For next week's code, tune into the Under the Canopy podcast. Now back to the episode.
But back to the amaranth issue, and we talked briefly about how what the situation started as, which is a discharge of a firearm in an improper manner. The police could not get involved with this situation in particular because by the time the neighbors complained, the target shooting was done and the police didn't have a opportunity to see firsthand and witness, or have witnesses to say that person in particular was the one that pulled the trigger. And what we worked together through, you and I and another counselor on, so the township of Amaranth, I'll just go back at one step. We put together a bylaw committee that was specifically put together for this in particular, this situation in particular. And that was the Discharge of Firearms Committee, which I was a part of and you were invited to, thankfully. So we knew we had the problem and we knew the perspective from the OPP, which is, and you made the point, I was being a little bit facetious, and but you did make the point, it's difficult from their end. And they helped us as a township craft a bylaw that ultimately give them access to the property.
Yes. Yeah. Help the local police force navigate their abilities more.
That's right. So there was a lot of opposition, I might say, on that committee. The committee was, and all committees are typically, you try and design them as a cross-section of people from different places within the township and different positions within the situation. But again, like I mentioned in municipal law, a lot of people don't give two shits about municipal law. They don't care about the township. The only time people care about the township is when their taxes go up. And why did my taxes go up, right? So I'm not sure if you include myself in it, we had a pretty decent cross-section, but it definitely skewed to anti-hunting. And I'm not, however it worked out, that's just the way it did. So we had our hands full in the education side of things. And there were some times where I was very frustrated, and if I don't think I had, and you are a trained professional, and people need to understand that when I say that, I mean it wholeheartedly, and I saw it firsthand, because there were situations when we were in these, I'm going to call them debates, with the people involved, because the people involved literally were the neighbors complaining, the people that got their house shot, and a couple of other volunteers that we worked really hard to find and convince to come, myself and another counselor and yourself. And there were times when I really could have, without your professional help, said shit that I shouldn't have said. And there were a couple of times where I come close to walking the line. But it was okay. I did all right. But you are a professional where you defuse, educate. Data, here it is. Data. Oh, excuse me, ma'am. Where did you get that stat? Because that's not true. Oh, yes, it is. No, well, actually, here's the data. This is the data, right? So, by the time this 3 or 4 month process, which I think is a pretty good time frame for what you do, once that the process was over, we had involved the OPP, we had involved all parties involved, we come up, and these bylaws need to be voted on by council. So it's not like the people on the board that were discussing it were going to make the rules, because our job was to draft a bylaw to be put in front of council
For consideration,
right? So at the end of it, we basically come up with a bylaw that, and you can jump in here anytime. I know it's been a while ago, but we come up with a bylaw that gave the OPP the ability to go onto the property, and then they could first and foremost see what kind of infraction happened. And if they could find something, then they could charge that way. But the real deterrent was, once we got onto that property, the bylaw said that the township itself could impose there was no provincial charge through OPP, but the township could impose a penalty that you would pay, right? Am I getting that close?
It provided an avenue, and we are dating back. I've dealt with so many of them, but in that situation, I remember it well, and it was kind of making the landowner responsible.
That's exactly what it was,
for the actions that happened on their land. Yes. And what was important about this situation was the situation had happened already.
Yes, it did.
So in reality, it should never happen again.
That's right.
Right.
It was all totally prevention,
which puts a lot of onus on individual to make sure that if they are target shooting, to do it in a safe manner.
Yeah.
You know, you touched on, I was kind of chuckling, and I'm sure Bryce was chuckling a little bit. It's important, you know, you talked about it can be challenging when people are trying to restrict and take away something.
Yes.
And it can be challenging because everyone is passionate about what they do, whatever they do. In our situation, we're talking about hunting.
Yeah.
And when people try to take away our ability to hunt, it's very easy, or fish, or it doesn't matter the topic.
Yeah.
It can be easy to be overreactive. It is easy to get worked up and be angry or say things that maybe you shouldn't say. But the unfortunate part of that is that can also work against you.
Absolutely.
And in this situation, some of the folks on the committee, it worked against them.
Absolutely it did.
Right? I always joke, like, I'm going to kill you with kindness.
Like, and you did.
You know,
and I learned a lot from you in throughout that process.
Well, and that's, you know, I love working on these. And this is one of the reasons why Delta Waterfowl is such a reputable name. We've had politicians say, we want to talk to you because you're reputable. It's important to keep calm. It's important to have a good, sound conversation. It doesn't mean we can't disagree on a topic, but I'm not going to sit here and yell at you.
No.
I'm not going to sit here and degrade you. I'm not going to sit here and say you're an idiot.
Yeah.
I might be thinking it, but I'm not going to say it,
yes.
Right? It's important to, like we talked about, the stats, the education, you know, the importance of just making sure people know what is actually true.
That is the biggest hammer right there, because it was so easy for the people on this committee who were throwing out bullshit stats that they could not back, saying untruths.
And you're not going to win that battle.
But the problem is, and it's a great thing you're there, because you don't win that battle when you're there. But when you're not there, those people do win. And that's how we get all these bullshit restrictions that go under the cover of night, or it's not even that. When you're in municipal law, it happens fast. And if you see, like me, see what's going on, you can scream at the top of your lungs and they people just don't listen.
Well, that's why it's important.
Until it's gone.
That's why it's important for, you know, we're here, you know, trying to sell membership. We're trying to grow our number. That's why we rely on our local support.
Yeah.
Because I can't be everywhere. You can't be everywhere. No one can be anywhere. And stuff happens all over the yes. province. And sometimes it happens in a council room with nobody in it.
And that's what was happening.
And it goes quiet, right?
Yes.
So we rely on our local folks, our chapters, our members. Yes. They, you know, I'm an easy guy to get a hold of. Eyes and ears on the ground, right? And then we kill them with kindness.
Yeah, you know what? I think just by talking to you and talking through this, that is probably the most important thing that anybody out there listening can do, is have your eyes and ears on the ground. And when this stuff pops up, now, like I say, we were blessed to have the fact that I was in there, and I am a person who is a huge advocate of our God-given rights, which angling and hunting and using our lands for sustenance. I'm a huge advocate of that. And then having you there armed with absolute silver bullets, because those people that we talk to, and at the end, like, I mean, you brought them around to the point where we had a bylaw that did exactly what we wanted it to do. It preserved our hunting and shooting heritage. And the people that were totally against what was against this idea, and the ones that brought the people that had their house shot, listen, that is a huge issue, and we are here to help you with that. We are your advocate when that comes, because
100%.
It's stupid people out there that started this whole thing, and I, as an advocate of the sport, do not have time for people that act in those ways. But when you have other people jumping in who are not people that have hunted or thought about it and are totally against it because they have their own beliefs, when you can come in, hit them with kindness, hit them with the big old hammer of stats, because there were many occasions and my problem is I was getting extremely frustrated because I didn't have the stats. I didn't have the leverage, because I feel it's wrong. I know what you're saying is bullshit. That's not right. But the difference is I'm not Brian, and I didn't have the bullets, the real stats. And you would just so calmly jump in and say, no, that's not right. But this is. No, that's not. That's not right, what you're describing. And there were a lot of times where you very eloquently set them straight and told them the stats, and that whole process was a total success, in my opinion.
Well, and that's the exact reason why we want to work with municipalities.
Yeah.
You know, I get looked at, well, Brian, you just work for Delta. You're just trying to get more hunting opportunities. Well, no, I want to educate people.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that our abilities aren't restricted needlessly. I want to make sure you have the information needed to make a decision, to make an informed decision. I can't control the outcome. I might be able to help sway which way you might go or how restrictive or non-restrictive that might be. But I need to make sure that you have the information you need to make a sound decision.
Well, and in Amaranth, that's what happened. We put together the bylaw. I had the information that I need to go back to council in front of the mayor, the deputy mayor, and the other three councillors, and present the information and say, this is good for us because of this, this, and this, and all parties agreed and are happy.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. It did take a while to get there, but we got there, and it was thanks to you and your hard work at the time that gave me what I was missing.
Well, and that's only, you know, that's the back end. And I always make sure to thank all the folks that showed up at the council meeting in support of the final product.
Yeah.
Because without that, it doesn't go anywhere.
Right? Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, that was fantastic. So listen, anything new with Delta? I know that you guys do a lot of work with we've talked a lot about the policy, but what about the ducks?
Yeah, well, we're all about ducks.
It's Delta Waterfowl. You know, what about the ducks?
You know, our kind of mission is to produce more ducks and secure the future of duck hunting, waterfowl hunting.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, we've got
getting out there and being Cupid and introducing men to women ducks. How do you get more ducks out there?
You know what? We're a science based organization first and foremost. We always have been, established 1911, and
1911. Yeah,
we're an old organization. And, you know, we do a lot of our research, Delta Marsh in Manitoba, not the only spot we do it, but, you know, our programs today are all based on the science and research. You know, we've got a huge million duck campaign on right now where we're going to add 1 million ducks to each fall flight. How are we going
to
do that?
Each fall flight?
Each fall flight. Every year.
You're going to add a million to the population.
That's right. And how we're going to do that is we're going to do it through programs that we've established through science and research, through our hen house program and our predator management program. So we've been doing lots of research, not me per se.
Yeah, but the organization.
Our organization and others doing a ton of research. You know, we've got these hen house programs and predator management programs happening in the prairie pothole regions. So Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. We have a hen house on display at our booth right now. It shows if we can get mallard hens up off the ground, their nesting success rate goes up by like 80%.
Wow.
It's because really and getting the predator management in at time of the year when hens are on their nests, you know, might be other species, especially ground laying birds. If we can, you know, keep the predator numbers in check, we have less raccoons eating eggs, we have fewer skunks eating eggs, etc.
Yeah.
So through this program, we're going to boost duck production and put more birds in the air each fall.
That's fantastic.
Why is that important in Ontario in particular? Is because a huge percentage of the birds we see
are nesting on the ground.
Are nesting? Well, they're coming from the prairie pothole region.
Yeah.
Right, on their migration, so they're passing through Ontario
on Lake Nipissing in particular.
There's a few.
Yeah. Well, that's great. 1 million ducks. So what do these...
It's called our Million Duck Campaign.
Yeah. So what do these nests look like? You're off the ground.
Yeah. So it's really cool. Picture chicken wire.
Yeah.
Okay. Like inch by inch chicken wire or inch by 2 inch chicken wire.
Yeah.
And it's rolled into a tube.
Yeah.
But there is, you know, depending on where you are, flax, grass, or you know, you could use anything, but like a hay material.
Yeah.
That when it's flat and you roll it up and you put it together. So it's essentially like a cylinder.
Yeah.
And then you stuff a little bit extra material inside.
And it goes all the way around.
It's a circular, right?
So there's the top, the bottom.
It protects from predators from a top. Yeah. And then obviously they're installed, generally speaking, in the wintertime when you can get out on access onto the ice, right? You drill a hole, you get a metal pole put down, and there's a base for it. So as it melts, then you have the cylinder tube that is in the marshes, etc.
Yeah.
And mallards will get up in there. and they're being protected. Predators can't get them from the bottom.
So it doesn't sound like a typical nest.
It's not like a wood duck box, right? And which we have chapters installing tens of thousands of those as well, which work extremely well as well. This one is through science. It's the best way for mallard production.
Yeah. So how do the mallards decide after years of they're nesting off the ground?
So when, obviously when they're going for their nesting, they're looking for a safe and secure location, right? So they find these and, they got huge success rates.
Awesome.
They get up in there. They have their ducklings, right? They see them through. They're protected. And that's where you see some of our pictures with the ducklings jumping out into the water for the first time, right? So through the million duck, and I'm not the best person to talk about the campaign, and I'm definitely not a scientist, but it's exciting because through those programs we're boosting duck production.
Wow, and it's not insignificant.
No, it's not.
It's not insignificant,
and it's all based on science and research. What is best, right?
So now, how can people? Do you sell these duck nests?
No, so we don't sell them. Our chapters, in particular, do a lot of work for that. I talked about when chapters do fundraising dinners, a portion of that money stays, within the local chapter.
Yeah.
These are the types of programs that our chapters get involved with, making these hen houses, making wood duck boxes, the programs, getting youth educated, all that sort of stuff.
So for anybody out there that has property, that wants to help, how do they, can they make their own?
Sure. Yeah, we actually have designs on our website on how to make a hen house, how to make a wood duck box. Anyone can do them. They're easy. They're a fun activity to do. If you want to get involved, Delta Waterfowl is always looking for volunteers. We're always looking for people to get involved at the local chapter levels, etc.
So that's the best way, the local chapter
absolutely,
level.
Absolutely. Because then, again, you get that community piece, right?
Yeah.
And, you make sure, they're checked every year and, it's a lot of fun.
That's amazing.
It's a lot of fun.
That's amazing.
Kind of a duck geeky thing. It's a lot of fun.
So you've got the politics looked after. You're producing another million ducks a year. Is there anything else that Delta is doing right now that you'd like to touch on, or have we pretty much covered our bases?
You know what? We've talked a lot about it, right? We've got our three recruit, retain, reactivate. Yeah. We're introducing new folks. We're providing access to opportunity. We've got our science and research programming that we always have going on. We have our university hunt programs. We have chapter dinners happening across the country, raising money and getting involved local communities. The maybe not so exciting part, the advocacy stuff that I work on.
Well, I disagree, but that's okay. we've been known to disagree before.
Yeah, that's all
right. Not much, actually, I don't
think. I'll just kill you with kindness, that's all.
Well, problem is I know you've got the silver bullets because I don't have all the data. And it's wonderful. It's great to catch up with you, Bri.
Yeah, absolutely. No, thanks and, for the opportunity.
Thank you for doing what you do. Whether or not you call it your occupation, I know that you're passionate about it. And it's important that we have people like you. And all I can speak for is the people of the township of Amaranth who have no idea who you are. And 80% of them would have been so adversely affected if you hadn't have done the job that you did. And I'm going to thank you for all of them. And I know you've got hundreds of thousands of other people out there that don't know who you are and don't know what you do, but are, if they did, they would be so grateful. So I'm going to thank you for them too. I really appreciate that. I appreciate your friendship. And I want to thank you for coming on Diaries of a Lodge Owner.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity.
Anytime, Brian. And listen, folks, thank you so much for listening to the end. I appreciate it. I know Bri appreciates it. And go to Diaries of a Lodge Owner. Check out the backlog. We got a ton of great topics. We've got some gear in the back there. I know Joss has told me to tell everybody that there's some wonderful products to buy. And again, thanks, folks, for making it to the end. Smash that like button, follow, go and find us on Spotify and Apple Podcast especially. And this brings us to the conclusion of another episode of Diaries of a Lodge Owner.
I'm a good old boy, never meaning no harm. I'll be the all you ever saw, been reeling in the hog since the day I was born. Bending my rod, stretching my line. Someday I might own a lodge and that'd be fine. I'll be making my way, the only way I know how. Working hard and sharing the north with all of my pals. Well, I'm a good old boy. I bought a lodge and lived my dream. And now I'm here talking about how life can be as good as it seems. Yeah.